Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Spiritual Unity Radio Network, a station dedicated to the concept that all manifestations of the divine are equally valid. Join Reverend Terry Power HP, Robin McKean, and all the hosts for programming covering a wide range of spiritual topics, right here on Blog Talk Radio.
Hercules Invictus and Athena Victory celebrate the mythic impulses of ancient Greece and Rome, and they invite you to celebrate with them. Welcome to Voice of Olympus.
Greetings and welcome. This is Hercules Invictus.
And Athena Victory.
And thank you for joining us here on the Voice of Olympus e-radio show on the Spiritual Unity Radio Network. Tonight, we have a special treat. We are going to be exploring the Olympian path and specifically Theurgy, which is a very ancient path which our guest, Brandi Williams, has brought back into the limelight with her book, For the Love of the Gods. Welcome, Brandi, and thank you for writing such a wonderful book.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
And we're excited to have you here. This is a very unique book in that your approach really brings you into the lives of the people who brought us these philosophies. I've never seen that done before. It was a very personal journey.
Yes, thank you. Actually, there's a story about that. I love history and I write about history. And I discovered that if I say I'm going to tell you a historical thing, that people will kind of tune out to that. And so I tried a lot of different things to get people to kind of let me talk to them. And it turned out that people love stories. We love to hear about how other people lived, right? So I said, I'll tell stories. And then it worked. Then the book took off.
And it brought you not only into the lives of these people, but extended past their lives into what their world happened to be like and why their world would inspire such thoughts in them. So you're an excellent storyteller.
Oh, thank you.
Now, as everyone's spiritual journey is unique, yours is unique also. Would you care to share your journey with us? You're a magician, you're a witch, you're a theurgist, and I'm sure a lot of other things besides a beekeeper. So can you share your spiritual journey with us a little bit?
Sure. I was born Catholic, and I was reading through some of your interviews. I discovered that's not so unusual. A lot of us were, actually. But I found early in my life that this path wasn't speaking to me, and I began to look for what did. I found a book on witchcraft when I was 16, and I said, that's it. I'm a witch. I have come home. And I followed the path of the witch for a long time. But being a witch will actually bring you into contact with the whole magical world, the whole world of magic workers as it is today. And I discovered ceremonial magic and a lot of similarities between witchcraft and ceremonial. There are differences,
yes.
There are different paths, but they all rest on a common foundation. And so I became a ceremonial magician, and it spoke to the geek in me. It spoke to the part of me that loves to learn and read things and be formal. And it also spoke to the need to do ritual and how to do ritual. So I continued that path. And then I became interested in theurgy because I was interested in what what formed magic, how we think about the world and how we can what the foundation was of that. And I discovered that philosophy was that foundation. I think of it as the operating system of magic. So I got interested in exploring that as well. And so that's what took me down the road of studying history and studying philosophy.
And before you wrote For the Love of the Gods, you wrote other books on these different stages of your spiritual journey.
I did, and I know them to be a story arc, but I recently realized that most people don't realize that I'm writing a series, so I'm starting to try to explain that and write about that as well. So my first book is called Practical Magic, and Llewellyn put it in the For Beginners series, so it's called Practical Magic for Beginners. And I really love this book because I'm coming back to that work a lot, because it talks to the foundational understanding of what we do, how elements and planets work together as energies. And I wrote the book as a practicum. You can pick up the book and say, I need to get a new job. I need to find a place to live. I have a real-world problem to solve, and I can solve it right away immediately. And the book doesn't require you to learn a philosophy or learn a religion. It just talks straight to the techniques of magic. And so one of the ways we describe this is thaumaturgy, right? There's that word that means you use your magic to make stuff happen for you in life. So that's what that book is.
You're making a miracle.
And yes, exactly. And some people look down on that, right? It's low magic as opposed to the high magic of theurgy. But low magic gets you, you know, a place to live and food to eat, and keeps you grounded on this plane so you can do the high spiritual work. So I have a great fondness for it, and I think it's an important foundation for what we do. And then my second book, actually, Practical Magic for Beginners was my second book. My first book was Ecstatic Ritual Practical Sex Magic, which is once again in print. So I should probably mention that as well. I started out as a sex magician, and I still am, in fact. I'm a fellow.
Is that from Llewellyn as well?
No, that's Emanian. That's probably why I thought of Practical Magic first. But Emanian Press republished the book. It was published initially by a British publisher who's no longer extant. So Emanian Press has it. It's in print. It'll stay in print. And I'm very proud of it, actually. I wrote it as my first book, looking at what people did with sex magic and realizing that I had a way to describe it to people and make it accessible, which is kind of my theme. I like to take magic and make it possible for people to do. And I was the first person to write, too, about being able to use the energy of magic and to address the idea of AIDS. If you trade body fluids with people, then you're exposing them to risk. So mm-hmm. There are other ways to do magic. You don't have to use body fluids. You can if you want to, but you don't have to. So I addressed that and other ethical considerations as well.
So these books are a series, you said?
So Practical Magic for Beginners I thought of it as the Practical Magician. My next book was called The Woman Magician, and that's how I thought of it, The Woman Magician. Women in ceremonial magic are thought of in a particular way, in a particular box, and I wanted to think myself into a way to be a woman and also be a magician at the same time. So I really took on the whole subject of gender in the magical traditions and worked to understand culturally, philosophically, and historically, scientifically. And I did this by invoking a series of spirits. I invoked Lady Philosophy and said, Lady Philosophy, tell me how to approach this. Lady Tradition, tell me about being traditional. So there were seven spirits that I invoked, and at the end of the invocations, I created a magical system that was for women, or any woman-identified person. Anybody who identifies as a woman can enter into this. That's my belief, my politics. Anyone who identifies as a woman can do this. The magic is called Sisters of Sashat. It's a sororal tradition in Western traditional magic. And I'm with the group now that is going back over and doing the rituals, and I know other groups in the country who are doing them too. So it's rather exciting. It's a place I find that ceremonial magicians, women who are ceremonial magicians, will get together and use the system because it allows them to get at some ideas. So it's very exciting, and I continue to love to work with women and work with the idea of gender. And then For the Love of the Gods is my next book in the series. So I thought of it as the pagan magician. And really what I was doing with that book was saying we are pagan, and paganism is not something that we invented in this century. We have not invented this idea that we're connected to the past. We are connected to the past. Continual thread from Hellenistic times to the present. We do Hellenistic magic. That's what we do. And the foundation of what we do is shared by all of these traditions. I was hoping to bring more than anything this sense of being part of something, which is another reason why telling the stories was really a helpful way to get at that. These are our ancestors, and we can claim them as our ancestors and feel kinship with them and understand that they weren't just people who wrote books or intellect floating in space, but they were real people. They were children. They were old. They had flaws, and they had loves. And they, in addition to all of this, they knew the gods and loved them and sought to teach other people about how to do that.
And one of the things I love that you did in the book was that you showed the urban aspects of these philosophies developing also, that these were folks that did have some money in many cases, that did have some leisure time, where they didn't have to worry about survival, where they could think lofty thoughts and delve very deeply into realms other than the mundane.
Yeah, there is kind of a class element to this as well. You know, there were people who could afford to do this. They weren't having to make the meals or clean the house. And I note that a lot of us are in the position of being able to read as well, and there are other people in the world who aren't. So there's a bit of a class distinction here too. But you know, it's interesting that you point to the urban nature of this magic, because this is exactly where we are now, right? We're in a world where we live in cities, where the cultures of the world have come together, and we know a lot about how other people live. And this is what was happening 2,500 years ago, and in Alexandria in particular, all these cultures came together, and this is kind of the foundation of what we do, and it's why it's accessible to us, I think, because that's the way we live now.
It is the way we live now, and Alexander's conquest, regardless of I guess all the horrible elements of the spreading of culture, because there was a lot of death and slavery and things like that involved, it did allow people to communicate in such an extensive way that hadn't been seen since the day of the Phoenicians. And they started to discover that a lot of their esoteric information was very similar. And they started to make that distinction between the exoteric and the esoteric, and to focus on the similarities and to try to draw something greater from the similarities. And that synthesis happened again in Rome, and it's happening again now. So it's really an exciting time to be alive, because what always follows a time like this is a dark time where this information is hidden and squirreled away, and you can only get at it through initiations and belonging to dangerous groups and so forth. So we are very lucky in the sense to be living in this volatile time.
I think so too. It feels like the beginning of a dark time currently.
It
so
does.
I'm hoping that we keep the light burning. That's our job right now. It's fun talking to you though, because you really have this background understanding that makes it, you know, that makes us be able to go into some deep stuff. And that's really true. The idea that the coming together of cultures was something that let people get at truths, to think about truths in a kind of way that it applies to how humans live and not just a single culture. And something I think people find interesting is that there's this connection of culture from England really to China for thousands and thousands of years. We think of these as very, very disparate cultures. We think of them as very far apart. And we say, oh my gosh, how can these people in such, you know, so long ago in such geographically dispersed places be thinking the same thoughts? Because they were communicating. People could travel from China to England, and they've been doing it for thousands of years. So we have a common cultural basis. There are differences. It's important to acknowledge those. But there are definitely the connections are because we are really culturally connected with all of these people in all of these times.
And even here to the Americas, several authors have made very strong cases with illustrations on how the Phoenicians came to this country as well. and may have made up all those myths about the world ending and the oceans pouring off into space and sea serpents to discourage people from coming to the Americas, where there were tin mines and all sorts of other treasures. And yes. This person showed in South America depictions of the jaguar god that hinted at elements from the Hercules myth, where they had the jaguar guards strangling serpents and fighting something like a dog with many heads. And these were, of course, very reminiscent of the Greek myths. So that made a very strong case for the fact the Phoenicians did come here and did interact with people and leave their culture as they did in Greece and in other places.
Yes, and the Basques actually were fishing in the Americas until 300 or 400 years ago. There
yes.
was a reason that it shifted and they stopped doing it, but they were coming here. So really, this continent was not as isolated as we think of it as having been as well. You're quite right. It's very interesting, isn't it? It's fun.
It's fascinating. When I was growing up, I remember all of the cultures that we were learning about in antiquity were given to us as separate pieces, like in a puzzle. And they didn't really touch, but in fact, if you proceeded and studied their histories and studied their archaeology and the translations of their documents, these cultures had interacted extensively, so much so that it's sometimes hard to tell who influenced who, if you're studying the mythology especially.
Yeah, and I think it's less important to think about who influenced who if you respect all of the cultures equally, as opposed to try to prove that one of them was better than another. But also, also we have this sense in the modern era of trying to keep things separate. So people who are Hellenistic reconstructionists might look at Egyptian reconstruction and say, oh, we're not connected. And I don't know, you've probably looked at The Balance of the Two Lands, Jeremiah Lewis's book, where he had that exact experience. He said, I was working with the Greek pantheon, and then the Egyptian pantheon called to me, and my Greek reconstructionist friends stopped talking to me. And
yes,
then I
yes.
found Alexandria, you know. And so he gets so excited. No, they came together. Yes, they came together. Absolutely.
Yeah, Hermes Thoth is the biggest example, the thrice great Hermes, where that was a synthesis, and Hermeticism is the basis of Western magic. So that was a very powerful
yes,
thing.
Yes, indeed.
And the Hermes myth, too, permeated even Judaism, where I stumble across somewhere in my readings over the years that Hermes was thought to be the teacher of Abraham in some accounts, and in others he became the angel Metatron. He permeated all the cultures in the area, not just the Greek and the Egyptian culture.
Yes, and then passed into the Islamic world as Idris.
Yes.
And was one of the gods who was remembered in Harran, which was that connection, the sort of Turkish, it's a Turkish city now, that connects up our present day, the medieval or Renaissance times to ancient cultures as well.
And Hercules, too, he permeated many different cultures. He was the Baal of Tyre, the lord of Tyre, the king of the city. And so he made it into the Bible. And Hercules is in the Quran as well, where Muhammad sends a messenger to Hercules, and Hercules reviews nascent Islam and finds it good. So he gives like his thumbs up to Muhammad's messenger. So you find them in the strangest places if you look around.
Yeah, that's true. And it's part of the transmission, actually. I mean, what we're sort of working around the edges of is the many connections and the line of connection between us and the past. So we have the Neoplatonic teachers from Alexandria, and then that knowledge passes to the Byzantine world, to Constantinople, and also to Harran, to the city in the desert, and then back into the Western Europe through Marsilio Ficino and the people who were translating in Italy, and then to us. So there's a direct line of transmission, both of theory and of practice.
Yes. And a lot of people don't realize that not only were these areas more cosmopolitan, but they were more modern than we realize. And of all places for this to be drawing attention to, the ancient astronaut theorists have been drawing a lot of attention to this, but it's true. Back in Hellenistic times, they had doors that opened and closed automatically. They had you put coins in a slot and you get a beverage or a number of other things. They had moving statues. They had cartoon type of things with animation. The only one of these devices that most people seem to know about is the Antikythera device, which was a navigation computer on the sophistication level of a Swiss watch. And this is back, again, during Hellenistic times. But they had a lot of these conveniences, some going even further back, like in ancient Crete, they had flush toilets. So we don't think of the past in that way. We're taught that as we've progressed, we've evolved. And not that we've devolved, but a lot of the things that we consider modern were there in ancient times.
Yeah, it's a really good point. It's the narrative of progress. And if we're going to be the most progressive people, then we have to devalue the accomplishments of the past. We have accomplishments, but they're in different places, I think, than we center our attention.
What was it about theurgy that drew you? What was the resonance that brought you to that field of study? Beyond it being a pagan tradition.
I picked up a book, the Greek Magical Papyri in translation, and I had 20 years ago, and I had, as most pagans at that time, been sort of taught by academics that our tradition had been broken by the Christian conquering of the world of the Romans, and that the suppression of pagan religion had been absolute, that it was successful, that pagan religion was you know, wiped out, and that our modern neo-pagan revival was a revival. It was something that we were picking up the past and recreating it, and in some cases making it up, making up the sense of connection. So I picked up the Greek magical papyri, and they're 2,000 years old. They're both Greek and Egyptian, and I understood them. I understood how to work the magic immediately as a ceremonial magician, particularly Golden Dawn magician. And I said, why is that? I got very interested in what that was. So I started learning learning the history and learning the connection of Neoplatonic philosophy and ritual. What happened most successfully was this breaking of the idea of spiritual pursuit and of practical magical pursuit, the breaking of theory and practice, of philosophy and ritual. That was what was more or less successful with the Christian, what they call the triumph of Christianity, the Christian success at converting the Roman world and forbidding pagan practice to happen. It drove pagan practice underground or into folklore. The ritual was passed forward in text and was transmitted differently from the philosophy. The philosophy was right in front of us. We have a connection with the writings of Proclus and the Neoplatonists down to today. They've been preserved and they've been studied. But connecting those writings up with the ritual is something that's only started to happen recently. Scholars are now looking at what Proclus said he did and the Greek magical papyri and saying, wait, when Proclus says he's doing the ritual of ascent, he's doing the Mithras liturgy. That's that same ritual. We can put them together and re-knit that. So that's what the modern theurgists are doing. We're re-knitting the philosophy with the practice. Both of them are extant. Both of them are present for us today.
That is incredibly fascinating. And I've read your book. I've skimmed through the book as well to prepare for the interview. I'm going to write a review of the book, but then I'm going to play with the book for a while. I'm looking forward to exploring those aspects because, as we spoke earlier, I'm pushing 60 now, so my days of studiously going over texts and things is mostly the past, so I have to brush up on that as well. But I'm Greek by nationality and spent a lot of time my youth in Greece, and it never really died there. They weren't practicing paganism as paganism is understood here, but a lot of the folk practices were echoes from the pagan era. And at the time I was growing up, they didn't really understand the connection with antiquity, but they were still jumping over bonfires. They had this whole extensive beliefs on the evil eye and on cursing and hexing and the power of gypsies and all sorts of beliefs that had you viewing the universe in a very different way. Like, especially the evil eye beliefs. I remember as a child, I was told that Americans were stupid and spiritually blind because they didn't believe in the evil eye. And anybody with a brain can see that the evil eye works. So, you know, we were considered, for being Americans, as backwards for not believing in that. And at the time, also, the more educated people will tell you, oh, these are all superstitions from the past, until they got to know you. And then you'd hear all sorts of stories that were right out of antiquity. And also, even though heaven and hell had changed hands, the in-between realms were the same as they were during mythical times with the Nereides and the Horrones and, you know, all these type of mythical creatures and other than human races. Those stayed the same regardless of the change in, from Olympus to heaven and from Hades to hell. All the middle stuff remained the same. So that stuff never really went away.
No. Actually, I spent a week in the spring in Ceres Prefecture with a dance teacher who took us to the village where the Anastenaria walk on fire. They do that in the autumn. In the springtime, they do a whole set of observances around going around the town square and dragging a plow and throwing water on the ground while the church, you know, puts up signs in the parking lot going, come over here and sit in the church. You know, you don't have to go watch this pagan thing, you know. So it's very, even, you know, a few years ago, very much still alive.
Oh, yes. I remember one ritual where you had to go inside after a certain time because young men dressed in like furry like pants would go around and beat anybody that they found outside. So this was an old Seder ritual from antiquity. And here they were still practicing it during the days of my childhood.
So that was like the Greek version of Krampus.
Yes. really amazing stuff.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, of course, I know that you must be following the resurgence of formal paganism in Greece and the return of worshiping it on the sacred sites, which I find really wonderful. It's very exciting.
Yeah, there's a lot of political stuff going on there in terms of the Aboriginal religions not being classed religions, but social clubs, and a lot of the property is owned by the predominant religious organization in Greece, and they're renting it out to shepherds and to, you know, people who are not respecting it for what it is, but they won't rent it out to people who honor the old ways. So there's a lot of things going on there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's been going on for a couple dozen years.
Yes, at least.
Yeah.
We're going to go to a break now in a minute, and then we'll be back, and we're going to focus on For the Love of the Gods and some of your more recent work. Thank you. That half hour zoomed by incredibly fast. What we're going to listen to.
Is it half hour already?
Yeah, half an hour's up already. We have another half hour to go after the break, but this is so fascinating that the time just zoomed by. So I'm going to put you in the quiet room for a little while. I'm going to play some music, a Bone Poets Orchestra Oracle.
Come away.
is up to. She got business to conclude. She is older than creation, and she ain't got time for fools. Do you really want to see some future in the palm of your hand? Tell me, what's it gonna be? Do you really think you really wanna understand?
International Pagan Radio, a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week streaming radio station. We have informative Facebook page, interactive Facebook group, absorbing interviews with musicians, engaging shows with excellent hosts, and dynamic interviews with spiritual leaders. Come join us. We have the very best pagan music from around the world. We feature artists such as Dave the Bard, S.J. Tucker, Murphy's Midnight Rounders, Elaine Silver, Izon, Brian Hinkey, Robin Renee, Fawn, and so many more, all available for your listening pleasure 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We are also available on TuneIn Radio, so go to www.internationalpaganradio.com. It's all pagan, all the time.
You're listening to the Spiritual Unity Radio Network. Thanks for sticking around. And now, back to the show.
Greetings and welcome back. This is Hercules Invictus.
And Athena Victory.
And this is Voice of Olympus. And our guest tonight is Brandi Williams, author of the book For the Love of the Gods. Welcome back, Brandi.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. Let's go to your book now. For the Love of the Gods, as we mentioned earlier, it unfolds through a series of stories that give you all the background information that you need to really make sense of theurgy and the Hellenistic era, or the Greco-Egyptian era, as people call it. And then you have a lot of practical information in the book for folks who actually want to practice theurgy. And you even had a 101 section that broke it all down to its most basic essence, which was very, very refreshing. So what are the many ways that you would recommend people using this book? And before you answer, I was giving a talk on the seven heavens in the Amber Dragon, which is a metaphysical store here in New Jersey. And I had your book with me. This is when I was first reading it. And one of the people in the audience saw the book and said, "Oh, I'm reading that book too." So they had a lot of good things to say about you as well.
Well, I know I sold two copies anyway. That's great.
Yay.
I'm sure you sold many more than that. It's an awesome book.
Thank you. Yeah, so the very first place that I start with practice is to invoke the teachers. We are, and that's why the book starts with stories, because we are learning from the great teachers of the past, and they come down to the teachers of the present. I mean, the book talks about the people in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, in the modern world, and down to today. There are other teachers who are working theurgy. I must mention, for example, John Opsepaus. Many of us started our theurgic practice with his explanations of how the rituals work, and he's still writing and teaching, and his work is still
awesome.
Available on the web, so I recommend that. Yeah, but the very first place is to invoke the teachers, invoke the ancestors, and ask them to guide us and help us understand what we need to understand. And then the second place to go is this level of devotion to the gods, which is, some people call it Hellenismos, and you could tell me a lot about that, I'm certain. But the idea is that you have, when you're working with a particular deity, you understand who that deity is, what their name is, what kind of offering to make them. You can go with the Orphic hymns if you're working the Hellenic system. But whatever deity that you're working with, you understand those things about that deity and make the appropriate offerings. And then so far we're on really solid pagan ground, and where theurgy steps forward and where it's specific is in the specific rituals for interacting with that deity. So one of the rituals is to invoke the deity into yourself, and there's a whole process that allows that to happen. And another piece is invoking the deity into a statue. It's called animating statues.
Yes.
And that's the part that we're starting to revive in the contemporary world that kind of dropped out of our practice. Ceremonial magicians have been doing invocation to God form for at least 100 years in this revival. But only recently have we started to actually put deities back in statues. Now, I should say, though, that in India, people still do this. There are other places in the world where this is a routine practice.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
and so
that's
the short. That's the 101 on how to get started.
And it's an excellent book for people who know what theurgy is, and also for people who don't, because if you're not familiar with theurgy, this will give you a really, really good foundation upon which to build. And you also recommend which text the person should read, and you have a lot of supplemental information so that somebody can continue to build a foundation and build a practice on that foundation. During the break and in your book, my wife had brought up, how about folks who are not Greek, who want to follow a Greek path? Is that cultural
appropriation? Yeah.
So I'm going to pass the baton over to Athena, and we can start exploring that.
Yeah, I liked that you had it that the ancestors aren't necessarily people in your bloodline. They're the part of the entire human experience that can call to you. And
yes,
go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's really important, and it's important to understand that our ancestors include people of color. So our tradition does root in Egypt. The Greek tradition roots in Egypt, and the theurgists went to Egypt and studied and pulled information from Egypt and also from India. Pythagoras
yes.
went and studied in India and came back. And you can see the moment that the idea of reincarnation enters into Greek thought is in the Pythagorean period. So all of these people are our ancestors, and that means both that it's appropriate for us to pull on those traditions, and also it's appropriate for people of color to enter into these traditions. There are some, you may be aware, there are some pagans who feel that you have to have a blood connection to your to the culture that you're studying in order to work that line, and they will tell people of color, no, it's not appropriate for you to be in this in this tradition. So I think it's very important to understand that this is a very welcoming tradition, that theurgy welcomes anyone who comes and sincerely practices.
Yeah, now many people feel like they're ostracized or put out by things, because I know some Greek groups don't want to accept you unless you're Greek, which even though
yes.
my earliest calling was to the goddess Athena, and it's Athena's my name, they wouldn't like me because they would kind of say, well, you're not really Greek and you don't speak Greek, so you can't be Greek. Well, I'm not interested in being Greek. My connection's to the goddess.
And that's it goes beyond that, too. I've spent most of my life here in America. So even though I'm Greek and I've been to Greece and I speak Greek and read Greek and all this other, I'm Greek. I'm not Greek enough when I go to Greece
right.
to some people. So you're never going to get rid of that. People are always going to want to make themselves special and grant themselves privileges because of where they were born or how they were raised or what they believe.
The color of their skin or
yes,
their gender.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
And I think you're pointing to something that's rather dark, that all of these ideas are pointing to a sort of nationalism that the world is starting to move back toward. And you do find
yes.
it in the Greek pagan tradition. You find it in the Norse pagan tradition. If you're not of our people, then you don't get to have anything to do with our culture. You don't have any. And this is a political stance. We're now going to eject from our country people who are not of our bloodlines. And it gets us into this very isolationist place. But,
and that's
it's funny, too, because... Good.
No, I was going to say, that goes also back to you talking about theurgy being an urban thing. When you have a city where you have a melting pot, you have all different cultures, all different people together. And for me, Athena was in ancient times, she was the protectress of the cities. And that might be a
yes.
good reason for that. She's the goddess of wisdom, and she realized that you need a mixture of people to make a healthy society. And to get new ideas,
yes.
new stimulations going on in a society.
And
if you go into
that,
isolating, it's no good.
Yeah, and countering that tendency toward isolation is that wonderful tradition of philia, this idea that you have a hospitality to strangers. So it's
yes.
very strange to hear, you know, this rejection among Greeks, because as I traveled in Greece and I spoke a little bit of Greek, I was always welcomed warmly. And I find that in the tradition as well, that the ancient teachers, the Neoplatonists, welcomed anyone into their circles. And you didn't have to be pagan. They welcomed Christians into their circles as well. Our teachers, the Neoplatonists, are not just Greek. They are Greek and Kemetic. They're Egyptian. They're Syrian. And it's very important to, point to that. It's very tragic what's happening in Syria now, because these are really holy places for theurgists
yes.
that are currently under attack. So there are, you know, we can also talk about bloodlines. There, you know, who's a pure anything at this point. So I think it's important that we understand that theurgy welcomes everyone. And then the other half of that, we were talking about cultural appropriation too, and I wanted to point to a very lovely piece that Jenna Tlendrew has written. Jenna Tlendrew does the Avalon Within tradition, where she talks about being a priestess of Avalon. It's a woman-only tradition, and she's written a piece in a book that's called The Goddess in America: The Divine Feminine and Cultural Context. So I bet, Athena, if you haven't seen it, I bet you'd love this. And her piece is called The American Dilemma: Engaging in Non-Appropriative Pagan Practice. And she talks in particular about being an American and then interacting with Native American cultures and how to do that with respect. So she has an idea that if you're going to work with any culture, that to approach it, first you listen to people who are practicing that culture, and then approach with respect what they're doing and respect what their wishes are. So I live in the Northwest, and I am on Suquamish land. The Suquamish are our neighbors. We have a treaty, and I stand as an ally to help uphold that treaty. And we have an agreement. So I go to the Suquamish, and I go to their meetings. I went to a meeting where they were going to send people to Standing Rock, and they were talking. You know, they asked us to come and support, so I did that. But they will also say to us, you know, in this country, it's in my lifetime that we could practice our rituals again. They were illegal for a long time. That still hurts, and we're not ready to talk to you about our religion. We ask you not to try to ask us about it. So I don't. I don't ask them about it or talk about it or try to take on their names or their rituals. And I feel that that's part of respect, too. So it's important to have both of those understandings. That theurgy is accessible to everyone, and also we don't just get to walk in and take what we want. We have to listen to people as well. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Awesome answer.
Yeah.
We're going to have you on again soon because we haven't even scratched the surface here, and we're approaching the end of the show. You do other things. Well, you sing in choirs, you raise bees, you're an amazing lady. So tell us about these other things you're doing.
Oh, gosh. Well, and they all feel like part of the whole. I have a day job, too. So it all feels like part of the same practice. You had said something to me before the show started about your life being an offering, and that's kind of the way I feel about it, that everything I do connects up spiritually. Beekeeping turns out to be really important, because beekeeping will teach you what's happening with the planet right now. We know that there's something wrong, and bees will point to exactly what is wrong. It's a very, very fascinating practice. Bees are older than us, quite a bit older. A colony of bees is composed of individuals, but they all work together as a single, what's called superorganism. And so studying how they cooperate really can teach us how we can cooperate with each other, how we can be a human superorganism. And many people feel very spiritual as beekeepers. And also on a very practical level, we know that bees are dying. They are. I can cite you know, the statistics. And it's pointing to the way we're living in on the earth and growing food and what we're doing wrong there. So if you study bees, you can really understand that and understand how we can fix it.
Awesome.
So I think that's important. Yeah.
And there was a very ancient bee goddess, too. The bees were very sacred in many areas of the world all through antiquity.
Indeed. And you can I will say no more, but you could seriously geek me out on the history of beekeeping. There's beekeeping in Greece, and I told a story. Actually, I started one of the stories in For the Love of the Gods in a bee yard, and it was it's an historically accurate recreation of a bee yard. And people still keep bees that way in the Mediterranean. They come from the Mediterranean, actually. The bees that we use here in America come from that part of the world. So they come up to my part of the world where it's dark and it's rainy, and they don't do as well as say in California.
Now, where can people get your book other than from Llewellyn or Amazon? Is there any other or all of your books, actually? How can folks find them? Do you have a website that links to them?
I do. BrandyWilliamsAuthor.com. I'll have it re-upped in the next week or so. So BrandyWilliamsAuthor.com is my website, and you can find links to all of my books. And I try to collect them all from Ingram and Amazon and from the publishers as well. So my publishers are Llewellyn and Mannion, and you can get them there.
When I publish the review of the book, which should be by tomorrow if all goes well, I will put a link to that, and this way folks can go to the website. Or if you prefer, I can wait another few weeks. You can let me know when it's ready, and I can link to it then.
And I can point you to BrandyWilliams.org. It redirects right now. BrandyWilliams.org will redirect to BrandyWilliamsAuthor.com when it's up. So you could go there, too.
And what is your next work? What can we expect in the near future?
the first manuscript I turned into Llewellyn, Elysia really helped me with it. Elysia Gallo is the senior acquisitions editor, and she's a very strong proponent of theurgy. She's one of the reasons that we have this resurgence of interest in theurgy, because she seeks out authors and publishes their stuff. So when I turned it into her, she helped me shape it, and about half of that initial manuscript was what became For the Love of the Gods. So I'm working on the second half, and I'm kind of tentatively titling it The Soul's Journey to the Stars, where I'm now going to focus on the Neoplatonic idea of how the soul incarnates and the work that we do to move back to our home in the stars. And it's kind of interesting, too, because the work involves working with an entire pantheon. Athena and I had been talking a little bit at the break about people who work with just, say, the goddesses in a pantheon. And so recently I did a work where I did a devotional to the Dodecatheon, to the Olympian deities, and that really confronted me with some stuff because I cherish it, right? I'm like, okay, I can work with Hermes, and I really love working with Hera and the goddesses. Zeus was a big challenge for me, right? So I had to learn how to deal with the energies that Zeus represents. And it's very interesting. It's something that Proclus mentioned in one of the works that I recently reread, that you need to take a system as a whole and work through all of them. If you do that, then you can understand what your path is as a theurgist. So I think that if you're working with pantheon, it doesn't matter to me what pantheon you're working with, but it's probably a good idea to work with the whole at some point, so as to come to wholeness in yourself.
I've recently been, I've always worked with my dreams, but lately I've been extensively working with my dreams. And because my approach is Olympian, a lot of very obscure mythological material has been showing up in my dream content, including the goddess Aletheia, who you speak about in For the Love of the Gods. Aletheia means truth in Greek, and she's the goddess of truth, and she was one of the companions of Oniros, who is Dream, and she would be with him, often depicted on gates that led to the dream world, and he'd be holding a horn, which means that there were true dreams. If there were ivory, they'd be deceptive dreams. But all of this really obscure mythical material that I've had to look up afterwards on fade.com or one of the other really great online resources have been showing up in my unconscious. So I'm sure I stumbled across this information at some point in my explorations, but they're so obscure that they weren't in my conscious memory, but they're being fed through the stream that I've tapped into. And speaking about our return to the stars, most of my personal work is with that. I work with the planetary deities and the luminaries and the days of the week and things like that. So most of my personal practice revolves around those things. So I'm looking forward to
You must have been spoken to Tony Mrzwicki, who has the Greco-Egyptian magic book, which focuses on that.
I will look him up.
And if you haven't, he'd be a great person to have on the show.
Okay. You'll email it to me, and I will try to contact him.
I will do. He's one of the people, I think, who's the modern teachers of theurgy. And there are people out here who are doing the work even today who are taking on students. So I think it's lovely that to be part of that movement.
And how can folks contact you, aside from your website? Is there any other way you can be contacted if they want to learn more about you and your work?
Sure. I have a Facebook presence at Brandy Williams Author. And so just give me a ping and I'll add you. Yep. Friend me indeed. And I'm starting to build out that presence. This year I'm working on building out my online presence, and I'm going to be doing Facebook groups for each of the books, including I'll probably start with For the Love of the Gods.
Awesome. I will definitely join that group.
Oh, cool.
And I'm currently publishing things in a few e-zines. And they do take copies of reviews. So I think I'll submit a copy of my review of For the Love of the Gods. And the circulation there is around 90,000. So
that's very kind of you. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm really impressed with the book.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear it. It's very exciting to talk to you. Thank you.
Same here. And like I said before, we've just scratched the surface, so I'm going to invite you back on. Season 3 starts in May, And starting with season three, not in May, in March.
In March.
Season three starts in March, and every show will then be an extended show. So we'll have an hour and a half to talk.
Okay.
So I will we'll work that out via email, and I'll schedule you. And this way we can just get together again in March. And thank you so very much for this has been an awesome show, and you've written an awesome book. And I'm looking forward to learning more about your path and your writings.
Thank you so much, and well met.
Well met. Take care. Merry meet. Okay. Thank you so very much, Brandy Williams, and we'll talk to you again soon. And Athena, what's up with us? What's coming up with us in the near future?
Well, Hercules here has two articles published in the Magic the Magic Happens, Recreating the Mythic Multiverse, and another article called My Primal Vision. On Saturday, the 14th, he will be at the Amber Dragon doing the continuation of the Seventh Heavens. And at the Cresco Library on Thursday, the 19th, he has a new series of workshops called the Dream Journey.
And that will be a year-long journey. Each class will stand alone, but together they'll synergistically collect. And like all my things, you'll pick up tons of Greek mythology while you walk that path. And next week, we have Pat Shand, author and artist of Zenoscope's comic book series, Godstorm. So thank you, everybody, for joining us tonight. I look forward to getting together with you again next week. And until that time, joyous journeys and happy adventures.
Thanks for listening to the Spiritual Unity Radio Network. Join us 7 nights a week for exciting programming covering a variety of expressions of faith. And remember, all manifestations of the divine are equally valid.